From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Bud Mishkin, and this is On Point. All caps, just before midnight. Never, ever threaten the United States again, or you will suffer consequences the likes of which few throughout history have ever suffered before. We are no longer a country that will stand for your demented words of violence and death. Be cautious. The author, the president, putting Iran back on the front page. Also, revelations this weekend about Carter Page. Michael Cohen has tapes. Deadlines for separated children. Pompeo on Russia and North Korea. Paul Manafort's trial gets underway. This hour, On Point. Top reporters open their notebooks and look ahead to the week in Washington. You can join us on air or online. What do you make of President Trump's Twitter threat to Iran? Or is this just a distraction to quell Russia headlines? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is David Ignatius, columnist with The Washington Post who covers foreign affairs. You can find a link to his latest piece headlined, "The Intelligence Community Has Never Faced a Problem Quite Like This," at our website, onpointradio.org. David Ignatius, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Bud. Great to be with you.
Also with us from Washington is Byron York, chief political correspondent for The Washington Examiner and a Fox News contributor. You can find a link to his latest piece headlined, "FISA Warrant Application Supports Nunez Memo," at our website, onpointradio.org. Byron York, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Bud. Thanks for having me.
And later this hour, we expect to be joined by Juana Summers, senior writer for CNN Politics. Gentlemen, thank you both for being here. We did not have to wait long for the week of news to start. It started last night late with a tweet from the president about Iran. Byron, we'll start with you. What was your response to it?
Well, first to address the sort of elephant in the room, which you already mentioned, which is the idea that Trump has now changed the subject dramatically. Last week was Russia week, and this week will be Iran week. And it does show you the power of the president's ability to absolutely hijack any news cycle before it begins. Trump's tweet went out after 11 p.m. Eastern time on Sunday night. On the other hand, going to the substance of the president's tweet, this tweet comes amid growing tensions and conflict between the U.S. and Iran, basically stemming from the United States' decision to pull out of the nuclear deal. We've seen the United States threatening to try to stop all Iranian oil exports. You saw Iran's leaders responding to that, and basically it's gotten ratcheted up into talk of war. And then there's this finally, there's the North Korean example, in which a number of people have noticed that this president's tweets, this particular tweet, an over-the-top threat of war, is somewhat similar to what the president was doing a while back with Kim Jong-un in North Korea, something that the president believes was successful and led to the current talks over Korean denuclearization.
Byron, is it a tweet that could have gone out at any point over the past month, shall we say? Or is there something specific in the last couple of days?
I think it was probably a response to the speech by Rouhani, mm-hmm. In which he basically brought up the prospect of war, saying that peace with Iran is great, it's the mother of all peace, and war with Iran would be the mother of all wars. So it's specifically a reference, I think, a response to that. Secretary Pompeo also gave a speech about Iran very recently. So this stuff has been happening in the last few days. Not a surprise that the president would respond on July 22nd.
Let's hear from the Iranian president. He was addressing a gathering of Iranian diplomats yesterday. President Hassan Rouhani cautioned President Trump against pursuing hostile policies against Iran, warning that, quote, "war with Iran is the mother of all wars."
Don't play with the lion's tail. You will regret it forever. You cannot carry out these measures. It is out of your capability. You cannot force Iranians to act against their own country. You have clearly shown you are against the Iranian people.
David, we have that speech from the Iranian president. We have the resulting tweet from the president late last night. What is your take on it?
Well, I think Byron hit the right basic points. The president is trying to, and to some extent is succeeding in changing the conversation after a head-spinning, jaw-dropping, juicer, exclamatory description week following the Helsinki summit. I think that beyond the rhetoric, and we have to note this is pretty extreme rhetoric. It's not just the all caps Twitter usage. The president, in effect, is threatening war against Iran, and the specific phrase, consequences the likes of which few throughout history have suffered before, makes you wonder if he's specifically threatening nuclear war, much as he did with Kim Jong-un. So the fire and fury tone of this, the emphatic nature of the warning, not, as I can see, justified by anything that Rouhani said. It was a fairly standard Iranian set of comments. It's further evidence that we have embarked on a process of squeezing Iran through sanctions, through other kinds of pressure, which I think is part of an undeclared policy of regime change. John Bolton, the national security advisor, was specific before he took that job. He believes there should be a change of regime in Iran. Mike Pompeo, back when he was CIA director a year ago in a speech at Aspen, came pretty close to saying the same thing. When I look at the things that we're trying to do, sharply squeeze Iranian oil exports and income, propaganda, the American encouragement to Iranians to rise up against this regime, Pompeo's specific statement in his speech over the weekend that we're going to try to use our radios to make sure the message gets through to the Iranians. All those things tell me that this is a policy of slow motion regime change. My biggest fear, just to end this comment, is the last thing in the world that the Middle East needs right now is another failed state. And I fear that this policy to weaken the Iranian economy, create a greater political disorganization in that country, play at its divisions, in the near term, maybe in the long term, could lead to a change of regime and the kind of regime we'd all like to see in Iran. But in the near term will lead to chaos, internal division, greater economic hardship, probably a more authoritarian government still than what they have. And I just don't think that's the path forward for the region or indeed for the kind of Iran we want.
You both mentioned the speech by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library yesterday, in which he harshly criticized Iran's leadership. He accused it of widespread corruption at the expense of its citizens' welfare.
The Ayatollahs are in on the act, too. Judging by their vast wealth, they seem more concerned with riches than religion. These hypocritical holy men have devised all kinds of crooked schemes to become some of the wealthiest men on earth while their people suffer. The level of corruption and wealth among Iranian leaders shows that Iran is run by something that resembles the mafia more than a government.
Byron, the notion that this might be employing, for want of a better term, the playbook from North Korea, be belligerent and then have it result in a summit in which the entire world is watching, which I think we can all agree is something that the president loves, is that even conceivable when we talk about this country, this government, and its relationship right now to Iran, that somewhere down the stretch or down in the near future, there might actually be a summit with the Iranian leaders?
Hard to see that. One advantage the United States would have here is that Iran does not have nuclear weapons. But to this idea that David was talking about slow motion regime change, I think that's entirely possible. And I think that what we're seeing here is that the United States has enormous power to to do this sort of thing. I mean, when the Iranian nuclear deal was signed, there was a lot of talk about the United States join with European countries and that any action against Iran is always much, much stronger if you have unity among these groups. Now the United States has unilaterally pulled out. The Europeans are opposed to our having done that, and I think we're going to see that unilateral United States actions can cause Iran an enormous amount of trouble. Now, whether that's worrisome, I think, is really the main question here, because you can say that, you know, we already screwed up one really big country, Iraq, in 2003 by invading it on pretenses that turned out to be incorrect. And so to now try to effect regime change by other methods could still result in all sorts of unintended consequences. So I do think it's something we need to be very, very cautious about.
AP is reporting that Ambassador John Bolton says he's spoken with Trump over the last several days and, quote, President Trump told me that if Iran does anything at all to the negative, they will pay a price like few countries have ever paid before. David, about a minute left in the segment. I'll give you the last word on Iran before we go to a break.
Well, this Iranian regime is a nasty regime. It uses and abuses its power to destabilize its neighbors. That's something that the Obama administration understood, but never could do anything about. The idea of taking that seriously, I think, is correct. The question is how to do that in a way that's going to be effective, and that over time will lead to greater stability and security for the region, not greater chaos. And that's the puzzle I hope the administration is thinking through carefully.
Our guests are David Ignatius of the Washington Post and Byron York of the Washington Examiner and Fox News contributor. We are discussing the week ahead in Washington, and it's already gotten started, obviously, with last night's tweet from the president about Iran. You can join us in the conversation. Among the topics, Carter Page says he wasn't an agent of the Kremlin. Do you buy it? What do you make of Michael Cohen's tapes of President Trump? I'm Bud Mishkin, and this is On Point.
Hi, I'm Shankar Vedantam, host of the podcast Hidden Brain. This summer, we're sharing a series about reinventing yourself. We call it You 2.0. Add us to your summer listening for ideas about responding to life's messiness and chaos with wisdom.
This is On Point. I'm Bud Mishkin. We're looking at the week ahead with a panel of top reporters, and you can join the conversation. The Paul Manafort trial gets underway. Revelations that alleged spy Maria Butina was backed by a Russian billionaire. The Trump-Russia probe rolls on. Do you care? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm talking with Byron York of the Washington Examiner, David Ignatius of the Washington Post, and Juana Summers of CNN Politics joins us now. Juana, welcome to On Point. We've already talked. Our pleasure. We've already talked about the week beginning with the news last night of the president's tweet about Iran. So before we move on to what's lying ahead this week, we'll give you a minute to give us your reaction to the president's latest tweet.
Absolutely. I think this is certainly concerning people in national security sectors about the strong language that the president's used, tweeting in all caps, essentially a threat towards Iran. And I think that seeing that we have Mike Pompeo up on Capitol Hill this week, we're going to see a lot of lawmakers, particularly Republicans, pressed on what the president's positioning is towards Iran.
Under the heading of all politics are local, David and Byron, what is the domestic situation in Iran, and can we read anything into this that Iran will say something like this? They know they're going to get a response out of the president, and it shores up support for the leaders in Iran by doing so.
If you'd like me to lead off, but I think based on the information that I see, there has been a growing level of dissent in Iran. Over the last year, there was an outbreak of demonstrations that began in Mashhad in the east, as I remember, early this year, spread throughout the country. Almost every major city had demonstrations. And what was interesting about these demonstrations was that Iranians were saying, in effect, in part, stop messing around abroad, spending our Iranian money on adventures in Yemen or Syria. Come home, you know, an Iranian version of Iran first, you might say. And I think that the Iranians are anxious about internal protests. There were much more limited but also interesting serious protests in Khuzestan in the southwestern part of Iran just in the last few weeks. And if you noted Rouhani's statement, which seems to have prompted the Trump all caps threat tweet, he was warning the United States not to think that it could agitate the Iranian people, that we'll stand up to this, we won't listen to you. Now, maybe the Trump tweet has the effect of helping the regime unifying the Iranian people, but I frankly doubt it. I think the truth of the matter is that on my trips to Iran several over the last 10 years, Iran's a country that's surprisingly pro-American. The Iranian regime is not popular within the country. The clerics are often a subject of ridicule among ordinary Iranians. It's a very sophisticated, well-educated society. So I think the idea that there is ferment in Iran that the U.S. is playing on is probably correct. My only caution would be if you try to overturn the economy, create vast economic hardship, experience tells us that doesn't work in favor of the good guys, the reformers, but the bad guys who further repress society. That's what happened in Iraq when we sanctioned Iraq. It's happened in other countries, and I fear that's the consequence of the policy that the President Bolton and Pompeo are talking about.
One of the other topics that was raised over the weekend as we were looking ahead to the week of news involved the former Trump campaign advisor Carter Page, who yesterday denied allegations contained in a foreign surveillance warrant application that he was an agent for a foreign power. He spoke to CNN's State of the Union.
This is so ridiculous. It's just beyond words. You know, it's you're talking about misleading the courts. It's just so misleading going through those 400-plus page documents. You know, where do you even begin? It's literally a complete joke, and it only continues. It's just really sad.
Byron, you've written extensively about this today. What's your take on those comments?
Well, what we've seen new in the last few days, actually on Saturday night, was the release of this heavily redacted version of the warrant application, the secret FISA court application the FBI filed in October 2016 to get a wiretap warrant on Carter Page, which they got, and they renewed several times over the next several months. And I think what we saw in this, and this had been a huge fight prior to the release of what was called the Nunes memo earlier this year. What we saw in this is that the FBI did use the so-called Steele dossier or the Trump dossier as an essential part of its application to wiretap Page. Essential part is the words that the Nunes memo used, because you did have Carter Page did have a history with the Russians. I mean, the Russians, he lived over there for a while, tried to make it in the energy business. Russians in New York had tried to recruit him, and that's the case in which it came out that one of the Russians had referred to him as an idiot. But they had tried to recruit him. The FBI knew about this. This was a case they knew about. And so having that knowledge of Carter Page's previous contacts with Russians, it seems to me that the FBI was unlikely to get a warrant to wiretap him in October 2016 unless there was something new. And what the new thing was were the allegations in the Steele dossier, which are mostly completely unverified.
I want to bring you in a piece you did from a couple of years ago, a terrific piece for CNN Politics that was titled "The Forgotten Tribe in West Virginia, Why America's White Working Class Feels Left Behind in 2016. That was a piece that preceded the election. It was during the course of the campaign. My question is this. When we take the preponderance of issues and topics that are part of the Trump-Russia probe, be it the Manafort trial and obviously the Mueller investigation and the woman who's now in jail here as an accused Russian agent and so many other topics, and even this story about Carter Page,
If you were to try to get inside the head of Trump supporters whom you profiled in that story from a couple of years ago, do you think any of this back and forth on the Trump-Russia probe actually resonates, or is it just kind of stories that are out there, noise that's out, not noise, because it's important, of course, but issues that are out there but that don't pertain, and do you think that's how those Trump voters who you did a piece on a few years ago might look at it today?
Sure. And that's a story I reported out of one of the poorest counties in West Virginia, deep into coal country. And one of the things that really struck me when myself and my producer were on the ground there is the amount of people when they consume media, when they're hearing stories such as this one, who were very openly say, you know, we think the media isn't giving then candidate Trump a fair shake, that, you know, they felt like that people were just looking for a reason to put out negative coverage of this president. And I think one thing we have to look at when we're thinking about how the average American in communities like this one, full of Trump supporters, are looking at these stories, they're not getting into the nuance of the conversation that we're having right now, by and large, because frankly, most Americans aren't. They're seeing things like what the president tweeted on Sunday after the release of these documents, where he's saying that, you know, that that the campaign was illegally being spied upon, that, you know, the Justice Department and the FBI misled the courts. So they're more likely to see a tweet like that than to kind of see the ins and outs of what these documents actually say and the underlying justification behind them. And I think that's what makes it really interesting. Among supporters that I speak to today, even, most of them say, you know, this is fake news. Hmm.
David, as we look ahead to the week of news, again, as we've mentioned, we've got the Manafort trial coming up. But in a piece you did recently in terms of the effect of the Helsinki summit, you had an interesting line which said that intelligence agencies are resilient. They, quote, get on with it, as legendary CIA Director Richard Helms liked to say, part of your piece from July 19th. Is that over and done with? Or even if we are not talking about it on the radio, on television, are there lasting effects from what transpired during that press conference that won't make the front page of the paper or be on the radio or television?
Well, I think the question is how the country as a whole processes the spectacle, but the visuals of seeing President Trump in a fairly deferential mood at this Helsinki summit, and whether that rubs people the wrong way. It certainly has rubbed a lot of prominent Republicans the wrong way. They've said so publicly, privately. I was last week in Aspen and watched our Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, who's been, for a mild-mannered fellow, pretty outspoken ever since that press conference in Helsinki ended, in saying that the president is misstating the judgments that you know, standing up for what the intelligence community has found about Russian covert action and attempts to influence the election. I think we unfortunately are a country that has two narratives that don't really meet much anymore. And so if you're a kind of Fox News, a Trump supporter, you wrap all this into a narrative about the media and the elites are unfair to him. They attack everything he does. If you're on the other side, you see it as further evidence of Trump's people use pretty extreme language these days, questioning his loyalty. Going forward, I think that the center line here is what Special Counsel Robert Mueller does. He is an extraordinarily sophisticated investigator. The indictment of the 12 Russian GRU officers 10 days or so ago was an incredible revelation of how much our intelligence community has learned about their operations. There's a lot more that they know that they're not saying. What's Mueller going to do with that additional information? Will there be Americans who Mueller will charge with having been directly involved in the activities that have been part of the earlier indictments that have named Russians. We don't know. I've often said about Mueller, he's like a shark. You don't see him until a fin breaks the water, and then pow, he moves pretty quickly. So I think that's people will process what they see on TV and read in the Twitter feed, but it's really what Mueller does with the information that's going to be decisive.
Gloria is calling us from East Amherst, New York. Gloria.
Hi, how are you today?
Good.
I just wanted to go on the record for saying that it appears that the Trump administration will forever be under a cloud of suspicion unless the Mueller investigation is allowed to go forward and come to its logical conclusions. Our country is based on truth and integrity, and I believe that unless it is allowed to go forward, and we will never know whether the Trump administration is legitimate or is not.
Gloria, thank you for your phone call today. Byron, you wrote recently about Robert Mueller and the handing off, as you put it in the article, of key cases. What was behind that? What did you see there?
Well, that actually does go to what the caller was just talking about where Mueller is actually going. And we know on the issue of collusion or conspiracy or coordination, Mueller has charged a lot of people with crimes. Several have pleaded guilty, and none of those crimes have alleged this collusion as part of the crime. And what we've seen in a couple of cases that are quite recent, in the Michael Cohen case, Mueller handed off that investigation to federal prosecutors in New York City. And in this case of Maria Butina, the accused Russian agent, she was indicted by prosecutors at the Maine Justice Department. And of the 12 Russians that David just mentioned, the GRU officers who were indicted, Mueller indicts them and then immediately hands the case over to the Justice Department's National Security Division, leading a lot of people to ask, well, why did we need a special prosecutor to do that? But what I think is what you can probably say about these cases is that since Mueller handed off Michael Cohen to New York and he gave Maria Butina to the Justice Department, you have to think that perhaps those cases did not fall into the core area of his responsibility, which is searching for links between Russia and the Trump campaign to influence the 2016 election. On the other hand, none of us can speak definitively about what Robert Mueller is doing because we just don't know, and we've been surprised by him in the past, and we will be surprised by him in the future. But it is interesting that some of these people who you might think were deeply involved in this, after all, Michael Cohen is one of the stars of the Trump dossier, Mueller decided not to handle their case.
I'm intrigued by one of the quotes from that article in which you quote a former prosecutor who says, good investigators aren't good litigators, and very often the best courtroom lawyers aren't the best subject matter experts. Perhaps, and I stress that word perhaps, one of the reasons why, as you mentioned, these cases are being handed off. Let's take another call now. Jim is calling from Portland, Maine. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm here.
Go ahead, Jim.
Okay. I commented earlier about whether or not people cared about the Russian investigation and whether they closed in one ear and out the other. And I just wanted to call in and say that I do care, and I know a lot of other people that do care, and we're hoping that Mueller, the fact that Mueller was appointed by Republicans and that he is a Republican, that this lead-up isn't going to fall short. I personally think he's going to come out with that Trump seems to be guilty of sin. That's my personal opinion, but you never know what he's actually going to say until he says it. And I assume also that he's going to wait till after the midterm elections just to cover everybody's tail and not feel like he's trying to run the country.
Jim, thank you for the call. I don't think we should assume anything in terms of the chronology or the time of the Mueller probe. Juan, I'll give you the last word before we go to break, about 30 seconds.
Absolutely. I agree with you. I don't want to presume much, but what we do know about Robert Mueller is that he's a longtime Republican, former FBI director, incredibly well-respected, and someone who has so far, there have not been a lot of leaks out of this investigation. The president, of course, has said that it's been a partisan witch hunt, but it'll be very interesting to see what he does come forth when his investigation concludes.
It's also in a world in which the president tweets early and often, it's tempting to look at the head of the probe and not doing anything public and try to read into that. Having said that, that's not the way, as far as I understand, investigations go, to be on the front page of the paper or on the radio or television. And so the Mueller probe goes on. We're discussing what's to come this week in Washington and beyond. You can join the conversation. What do you want to see from Congress in the final week before the August recess? Will the U.S. meet the deadline to reunite separated migrant children with their families? I'm Bud Mishkin. This is On Point.
There's a new way to hear Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and all your favorite programs. Just ask your smart device to play NPR. Listen to your local station anytime, like this. Hey, smart device, play NPR.
This is On Point. I'm Bud Mishkin. We're looking ahead to the week in Washington and around the country. You can join the conversation. How do you think President Trump's meeting with the EU head will go this week? What else is on your radar? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Talking with Juana Summers of CNN, Byron York of The Washington Examiner, and David Ignatius of The Washington Post. The court deadline to reunite migrant children with their families is this week. Juana, what do you see from that? And what if the government comes into the court and says, we're doing our best, but we're not done yet?
Sure. I think we heard on Friday really a change in tone from that federal judge who had imposed this deadline to reunite these more than 2,500 children with their families after being separated at the border. That judge, you know, said that he was very impressed with the effort that had been made and that there was great progress that had been made after, I think, around 450 children, five and older, had been reunified. Now, there are still a lot of children who need to be reunited with their parents. We don't have new numbers today, but as of Friday, I think there were about 2,000 students who either needed to be reunified or ruled ineligible by that Thursday deadline. And some government lawyers were saying that complicated issues could pop up in the coming week. So I'll be curious to see whether or not the pace of these reunifications continues to be quick or if there are complications that pop up. This is a story that I think has really provoked a lot of deep sentiments among people with these jarring images of these young people who have been separated their parents in some cases for weeks.
David, is there a sense of what comes out of this or what you think comes out of this after Thursday?
Well, I think this is, as we head toward the midterm elections, this is going to be a significant issue. I think it has moved the country, forced the president to back down on his initial zero tolerance policy. It's hard for me to know how the details of immigration policy going forward are going to fit court requirements and the you know growing public agitation. I don't get the feeling that the Department of Homeland Security, the administration, have thought through carefully enough how they're going to make all these pieces work. But from my perspective, it's as much the kind of political debate and the way in which it allows us to read the political temperature of the country that's interesting on this.
The president of the European Commission is scheduled to come to Washington this week. There has been some notion of there being concessions from the EU or pressure inside the administration to stave off an automotive trade war. Byron, what's your take on that visit?
Well, Trump has already had such happy visits with the G7 and NATO. I expect this maybe to be a little less dramatic, but it obviously comes in the context of the United States imposing steel and aluminum tariffs and Europe threatening the same sort of thing, and now this big coming fight over automotive tariffs. So I expect it to be, largely about trade. On the other hand, given everything else the president is talking about right now, it might be a little less dramatic than what we saw with the G7 in Canada not too long ago.
I'd be love to be in the room when the president asks, "How are you?" and hear the response. Let's go back to your phone calls now. The EU is just one of many topics ahead in the week of news. Bill is calling from New Orleans. Bill, welcome to the show.
How about, the announcement of these meetings fills me with a substantial amount of dread, given the president's performance in past meetings. I'm wondering whether or not there exists any sort of potential for some regulation of his activities and things. You know, after the press conference with Putin, it was remarkable to me in many respects. One particularly was that when the president was speaking, you couldn't see Putin's lips moving, and you couldn't see the marionette strings.
Bill, thank you for your call. Juana, when we look at the EU story amongst many, is there some notion that if we do head into a serious trade war and then all of a sudden people find they're spending more for something, that will get the country's attention, specifically when it comes to the notion of trade wars?
I think it certainly could. If we look at this EU meeting in particular, this is something that we've heard the U.S. auto industry already come out. They've condemned these proposed tariffs, saying they could push up sticker prices on cars by thousands of dollars. And that's something that really will affect nearly every American household. The White House, though, has been hinting on this one in particular, that there could possibly be some kind of deal as they've hit so much political resistance here. So we'll be looking ahead to see just what happens in these meetings and whether or not they'll actually diffuse trade tensions, or if the dispute escalates and the president decides to go ahead and impose these heavy tariffs on European cars and car parts.
Another topic for this week, another story that lies ahead, is the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, to testify before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on the 25th. New Jersey Democratic Senator Bob Menendez told Fox News Sunday the only upside to President Trump talking with Russian President Vladimir Putin is if President Trump is willing to challenge him on key issues.
Now we're going to give him, a red carpet treatment and invite him to Washington. To me, that's beyond comprehension. You can speak to adversaries, but at the end of the day, you have to do it in a way in which you challenge them. The president seems to want to be chummy with Putin instead of challenging him.
And from the other side, yesterday on CBS's Face the Nation, South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham looked directly into the camera and told President Trump to be tough on North Korea.
Mr. President, North Korea is playing the same old game with you they played with every other president. You're being tough on China, and you should be, but China's pulling North Korea back. You need to make sure that China and North Korea know and believes that you're different than everybody else. Restart these military exercises and put on the table removing our dependence from South Korea as a real stern warning to North Korea what happens if they play you.
David Ignatius, you wrote in one of your pieces recently that improving relations with Russia is a worthy goal so long as it doesn't undermine security or reward bad behavior. What do we expect to come out of the testimony from the Secretary of State this week? What do you hope to see?
Well, the first thing I hope to see is a clear summary of what was discussed and what, if anything, was agreed. I think it's disturbing when the American public has to rely basically on Russian accounts summarizing what was said in this meeting. I think it was very unfortunate that the president decided to do it one-on-one, in part because it leaves us open to somebody else, the other side, shaping the narrative about what happened. So I think Pompeo, as Secretary of State, somebody who's I think maybe uniquely close to this president, needs to tell Congress what happened. He needs to honestly answer questions about concerns that people have about what happened. I don't think there's anything that should be disturbing about resuming serious dialogue with Russia about, say, nuclear arms control. I think that's overdue. The strategic stability talks, as they've been described, are in many ways welcome. That's something the Pentagon has been preparing for independently. I heard a Pentagon official a few days ago say that they had been sending messages about those talks, where and when they should take place before the president went to Helsinki. National security policy is now so tightly held in the White House by the president and John Bolton, even other key senior cabinet officials don't seem to have been adequately briefed on Helsinki. For example, Dan Coats said last Thursday in Aspen he hadn't been briefed yet on the summit that took place on Monday. How can that be that our director of national intelligence doesn't know what was said? So that's job one for Pompeo. Tell the country what happened and answer questions about it.
Juana, do you expect that something important might come out of the testimony, or can we kind of predict that the Republicans will play their role, the Democrats will play their role? Everybody understands how this goes.
You know, I have to say, in watching the reaction after the president returned from that summit and the news conference that he had with Putin in Finland, really, I saw a lot of Republicans across the ideological spectrum who were quite stunned by what they saw from the president and, as was noted, undermining his national intelligence director, blaming both the United States and Russia for these poor relations between the countries. What I will be most curious about, though, is what Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, actually knows, given that this policy and national security policy and structure has been so tightly held, given that this president has taken a go-it-alone strategy that is very different than what we've seen from presidents past on either side of the aisle when it comes to Russia and Putin, just how in the loop he is and how accurately he is able to discuss or reflect what the president's beliefs are on this, since he has really taken an insular approach to this.
It strikes me that so much of this and these topics go back to the old game show with the title, Who Do You Trust? If you're a Trump supporter, then you will trust him. And if you are a Trump detractor, then nothing he will do or say, you won't trust him. And maybe perhaps the question is for the people who can be swayed one way or another. Do all of these events taken together, do you think there, Juana, we'll start with you, do you think there is a group out there that is being swayed one way or another by all of the aspects of what happened in Helsinki and the Mueller probe and so on and so forth?
Sure, absolutely. I think that there's actually a pretty big split, and a lot of people, one of our teams was out and have several important states across the country talking to people kind of about all of these stories coming together. And it's just really fascinating seeing the slew of theories about how the president particularly handled that that summit, whether that he was just tougher in private, that he has a plan that he's just not letting us in on yet. There are certainly a lot of questions about this news conference. But I do think Republicans are trying to figure out how to reckon with the consequences of the Trump presidency in a situation where we publicly saw a president agreeing with a foreign adversary over his own intelligence agencies at a moment in which all the world is watching.
Byron, do you think there will indeed be consequences from that as we go back? We look ahead to the week ahead, but we're still going back to Helsinki. But with all these events that are coming up, do you think there are consequences for what transpired?
Well, let me talk a little bit about political consequences. Kind of contrary to our caller from Portland, who said he cared a lot about Russia and follows it, I don't think many voters are like him. And in the new Wall Street Journal poll that's just come out, the president had a 45% approval rating, which is actually by one point his highest rating ever in the Wall Street Journal poll. But he's bounced around. He bounces around a pretty small area. The lowest is 38, highest is 45. So I don't think it affects his overall approval rating very much. What I do wonder about for the midterms is, since I don't think Russia is a big factor unless Robert Mueller does some huge thing, you do wonder whether Democratic candidates can use something like the tariffs to argue that voters in this particular district or this particular state are suffering from what the president has done. And it seems to me that if I were running someone's campaign for the House or the Senate, it seems like an actual economic argument might be the most effective way to go.
David Ignatius, with just a couple of minutes left, this may seem a little far afield, but you, aside from working for The Washington Post, have written spy novels. And a few years ago, you were the librettist for a Dutch national opera called The New Prince about Machiavelli. And in fact, you were quoted in a paper as saying, the interesting thing about Machiavelli is that although he was a great exponent of guile and deceit and the need for the ruler to sometimes tell lies to achieve his gains, he believed absolutely himself in telling the truth. And I read that quote and I thought, as all of these stories unfold, do you think about this as grist for the mill for your next spy novel or perhaps your next opera?
Well, I'm pleased and flattered to that you mentioned this libretto. There's a way in which the Trump presidency just is so wild. I'm not sure it's the right kind of source material for fiction or maybe opera, because it's so extreme. We have a president who struts the stage, who is can be petty, vengeful, seems to sometimes want to humiliate others, boasts about his own achievements, uses Twitter as a kind of it's like he's holding up posters promoting himself. A novel could capture that. I think I'm not equal to it. maybe Byron or Wada could do it. I do think we're watching a drama that's about the future of our country and the world. And this is a good drama. We get to vote on what the next act is in November. And I think that's the thing I'd say in closing is, we'll learn a lot about the American public as we watch how they vote, what they're paying attention to, what they take seriously.
Juana, briefly, the story that you are most looking forward to watching in the next week, the most compelling story for you.
Absolutely. So one of the biggest stories I'm following is that on Monday, we're expected to see Robert Wilkie, who's a senior Pentagon official, named as the next Secretary of Veterans Affairs. He will be the third person that the president has nominated to serve in that top role in the last 18 months. And this comes as he'll inherit an agency that is sprawling, over 360,000 federal workers, that has beset with a ton of issues, including high-level staff turnover. So I'll be really curious to see as he steps into that role, and the White House says if he's confirmed, he'll be sworn in quite quickly, if he's able to turn around the ship at VA, which has had a really rocky several years.
And Byron, will give you the final word, about 20 seconds, the most compelling story in the next week for you.
Well, the one I'm going to follow is more on this FISA warrant that's the cause of such huge controversy. And the way to really solve some of the arguments here is to release it. And I've talked to some people who suggest that the really, really necessary redactions for it are probably pretty small. So I think there's going to be pressure on President Trump from Republicans to release as much of it as he can.
Byron York, chief political correspondent for The Washington Examiner and Fox News contributor. Always glad to have you. Thank you, Byron.
Thank you.
Juana Summers, senior writer for CNN Politics. We appreciate your time, Juana.
Thanks for having me.
And David Ignatius, foreign affairs columnist at The Washington Post, plus spy novelist and opera librettist. Thank you so much for joining us, David.
Thank you for the plug for the opera.
Sure. You can continue the conversation at On Point Radio. I'm Bud Mishkin. This is On Point.